Okay, so let's review from our last session. We finished the ox, and we are starting with the foot and the tooth. These are we finished the horn. So these are the three things that make up the ox, which is a damager. And we were comparing the two, foot and tooth, in order to draw out distinctions between how those two cases were different. And the Talmud always wants to know, why do we need each category? And what makes it unique? And what makes foot unique is because it is common. And what makes tooth unique is because the animal benefits from whatever it's doing. And then we got to the famous Rav Papa issue, which we will talk about again tonight, which are the consequences of the secondaries. Are they the same or not the same as the primaries? Rav Papa says they can be sometimes yes, sometimes no, but we haven't seen yet the case where it is no. And we'll see more of that tonight. And I mentioned vocabulary, the term chiddush, which you might recognize chadesh in there, or chadash, or chodesh, all of which mean new. So the goal of a Talmud scholar is always to look at the text that's been looked at hundreds of thousands of times and extract something new from it. And finally, congratulations to the group. We have completed our first daf, 2 pages worth of the Talmud, front and back. So with that, here's the handy dandy chart. So we have the 4 categories. And we had done horn, now we did tooth and foot, and those are the secondaries of them. So now we go on to the pit. Yes, so I want to go back to the original verse in the Torah to remind you, because it's been a couple of weeks, about the definition of the pit. So if a man shall open a pit, yiftach ish bor, or if a man shall open dig a pit, velo yichasenu, and not cover it, v'nafal shama shor o chamor, and falling into it will be an ox or a donkey. Ba'al habor yishalem kesef, the owner of the pit shall literally give money, yashiv leva'alav, to the owner. The owner of what? The owner of the dead animal. The hamet yihyeh lo. And the corpse of the animal will be his, the man who had to pay the indemnity. Okay, we'll come and take a look at that. Here I'm going to give you a clue for what the next thing is. Does it say anything about how big the pit is?
No.
That's correct. So here we go.
It doesn't have to be big, because he could break his leg if he's put the chips in it.
Okay, so normally, Mr. Gelbert, you're right on it, but here you're going to see you're a little off on this.
Well,
so the Talmud says,
you're always a little off.
The secondary of the boar, of the pit is boar, my nihu, one of those Talmud rhetorical devices saying, it's asking a question, what is this? And when you see those words, it means the Talmud's going to answer that question to clarify what it's asking, but it's at the same time going to introduce another problem that's even bigger. So it says, if you said the primary is 10 and the secondary is 9, neither 9 or 10 are written. What is 9 and what is 10? Was that in the text?
Yeah.
So the answer is, we had a local guess of amot, which are cubits, but that is not correct. In this case, it is hand breaths, Talmudic terminology. So just like an amot in the Talmud is the length from your elbow to your tip of your finger, which is about 1.5 feet. Another common measure based on body parts is a tefach, which is a hand breadth, so 3 to 4 inches. That's the smaller size.
You know, Stu's hand, that's like, it's Stu's Mantell's hands are like double that. So I don't know.
These are not Mantellian measures. They are average measures. So
I just measured my hand. It's 4 inches. Don't give me that.
I love that on the spot reporting. What else? Where else did you get that but in Zoom? So we go back to the text here again. And now we know that 10 and 9 are tefachs. So it's saying a pit of 10 tefachs, or about 40 inches, is a primary case of damage. And a pit of 9 tefachs, tefachim, is 36 inches, is a secondary case. However, we still have now, yeah. Question?
No.
We still have the bigger problem now of where is it getting this 9 and 10? What is it's not in the text. So Talmud goes on to say, and here's another Talmud term. You can tell I like these things, which is why I always emphasize them. Halo kasha. This is not a difficulty. And for some of the, I'm going to say, more experienced people here, they probably know the Yiddish word kasha, which is an Aramaic word, like the fear kasha we say on Passover, the four questions.
Yes.
So here it says, this is not a difficulty. Why? And now they're asking the question between primary and secondary. Because in the text, it said, let's go back to that quickly. If you look at the last line of the text, and the dead beast shall be his. So what does that have to do with anything? So the merciful one, which is God, said, and the rabbis had a tradition. 10 would kill, 9 would injure, but not kill. So here's what they're saying. That first of all, that a pit that is 10 hand breadths deep will kill. But a pit that is only 9 hand breadths deep would injure and not kill. So there, Mr. Gelber, you have the difference. 10 is a primary case because it kills. And we know that because the text says there will be a dead animal as a result. And 9 is just an injury. So it's a secondary category. How do we know this? And this is Talmud sleight of hand right in front of you. The rabbis had a tradition. So what they're saying there is, the rabbis just brought this up. It's not in the text of the Torah, but it's something that came down from Mount Sinai that they knew. And that's how we get 9 and 10, which is not explicitly listed. Not the first, the last time we will see this. Okay. Everyone good with this?
Yep.
Yeah.
Now we have sof, which I'm sure Sammy knows. That's modern Hebrew. That means, sof means end, sof means ultimately or in the final case. This is a primary of death, and that is a primary of injury. So this is the 10 hand breaths, and that is the 9 hand breaths. So that's how they have now decided this issue. Okay, now they're going to bring in something else from left field. We'll see a bunch of that. So, rather, Elah. Rather means what? It means it's going to be a reference back to Rav Papa. And he brings up another case, really, which is, if you place a stone or a knife or a load or some object in the public domain and it causes damage, in that case, that's a secondary. The secondary is equal to the primary, and that's referencing Rav Papa's statement about secondaries being equal to primaries. So this is another thing that can be causing of damage. And here I want to highlight the term public domain, which is Birshut Harabim, which is an important concept to understand. So now we go back into Talmudic terminology. So in the Talmud, there are four kinds of domains that are defined. And their domains are defined in terms of Shabbat observance, meaning it is a cardinal sin. It is a very bad thing to do on Shabbat to carry things from one domain to another. So what is a domain? The Talmud then has to come along and define it. So as I said, they define four domains, and the one we talk about here is the public domain. Now, how do you define a public domain? Well, it's pretty much what you assume it is. Technically, it is a street that is at least 24 feet wide, which is 16 cubits. Now we're back down to that. And then the rabbis went on to say, a place where 600,000 people pass by, which is a lot of people. And in modern terms, this becomes an issue with, which we won't go into, with Eruvs, like, you know, is the public street of Metuchen a public domain? You would tend to say yes, but probably 600,000 people don't go by in a day, whereas a street in Manhattan, that might be true. So you can get into fine definitions here. The other definitions that I just want to mention are the private domain, which is basically your house. So the classic Talmudic case is someone is standing in the public domain, like in the street, and they want to pass you something and you're in your house and it's Shabbat and they hand it to you through the window. Is that a problem or not? And finally, I have to mention, because my wife is here and she just enjoys this concept, but there's an intermediate domain called the Carmelite. And that is a domain that is intermediate between a public domain and a private domain. And it's basically any open area that is not a public space, or really a public thoroughfare, like a field or a beach. And
or a front lawn, Steve?
No, because that's not a large place. It's a public space.
Your front lawn
would really count as a public space.
That's part of your property. That would be.
It's not 24 feet wide, and 600,000 people don't pass by.
It depends. It would depend if you had a fence around your property. I guess in modern property terms, it might count as the private domain. Usually, it's considered to be in your door frame. Separates you from the public domain.
Are we going to discuss where this 600,000 comes from?
No, we are not.
Okay, you're going to make me crazy, aren't you?
Okay, well, I'll give you my educated guess, hopefully. So, Shesh Mea Elafot are supposedly the number of people that left Egypt in the Exodus. And that is translated as 600 Elafot. So in modern Hebrew, Elef means 1,000.
Right.
And that's where we get the figure of 2.4 million people on the Exodus, because that would be only counting male senior, adult men, yeah. Adult males. So when you add in all the components, adult females and children, you get 2.4 million.
Right.
There is a different reading I prefer, where Alafot, instead of being thousands, are clans. So 600 clans or family units or tribal units went out of Egypt on the Exodus. But that is not the commonly understood explanation.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Because that's a lot of people to walk by a place in a day, especially in, you know, 400 BC.
You're exactly right. And if men's
it's a lot of people to walk in the desert too.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
yeah, that's one of those problems.
No water.
2.5 million people really leave Egypt.
Yeah, so by this definition, then there is no public domain in all of ancient Israel, except maybe the temple grounds. Because where are you going to get? You don't have a population of 600,000 people.
Well, the rabbis added that, so that's, you know, 1,000 years plus after the Exodus.
Yeah,
and
well, but
it's a symbolic number.
Yeah.
If we were still in the era of men's club, I would say, here's your next topic to investigate the 600,000.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's not. And I'm still writing, making a note to look it up.
So by the way, that this is an important concept in damages, because the pit, I want to make sure I'm saying this right. The pit is really the first thing where we talk about being in the public domain. If you dig a pit on your own property, you're not liable for damages because it's private property. But you are if you dig it on Main Street. So that's where it comes from. Okay, back to the Talmud. Hechi demei, what is the case? We will see this a lot tonight. What specifically are we talking about? So we're going back to the case of people leaving objects in the public domain that will cause damage. If they were abandoned there, according to Rav and Shmuel, they are the same as the pit. So there's a couple of things going on here. So first of all, I want to talk about abandoned. This is another Talmud term. So the word for modern Hebrew is hefker, actually in biblical Hebrew. Hefker is ownerless property. So property is a real big deal. I think we talked about this in the very first session in Jewish law about owning things and property rights. And it's really a very important thing when it comes to American jurisprudence. I'm sure Renee would agree with that.
Yep.
But there's all kinds of rules about owning property and renouncing property and so forth. So hefker is a concept whereby a person says, I no longer have ownership of this object. So just to make an example, if let's say you put out something in the trash that was large and bulky, and someone came along and injured themselves, they tripped over it. If you had declared it hefker, you are not liable for it. That's abandoned property. Actually, I'm not even gonna say that because I don't know that to be absolutely true. But there is a procedure whereby you can declare a piece of property ownerless. There is a procedure whereby you can, the Beit Din, the court can declare property ownerless, which now means the Beit Din owns it and they can, the court, they can give it to other people. There's a point at which you give up hope that your lost property will ever be found. So that is the word hefker. And if we go back one, you'll see that large word in Hebrew, which I'm not even going to pronounce, which is the same root, hefker. So that's abandonment. Now, in a case where you declare the items ownerless, so Rav and Shmuel, who we'll see much of later on the Talmud, say that these things are subcategories of the pit. And they're just coming in to make that distinction. Okay. And we did hefker. So if they're abandoned, but what if they are not abandoned? What if I leave my, bricks in the public domain and you trip over them? So according to Shmuel, who says they are derived from the pit, they are equivalent to the pit. This is the pit over which one is obligated to, that you dug in the public domain. The digger does not own the pit, yet he is responsible for the damages that it does. Same way, the person who abandons the objects does not own them, but they are responsible for the damage that it does. So Shmuel is saying he would hold the person responsible as he would be for the pit. But Rav says this is not a case of the pit, this is a case of the ox, meaning the liability is similar to the ox that damages something in the public domain that the man owns. This will become a little more clear. The point you should get out of this is you're looking at this from two different legal points of view. Okay, I'm sorry.
With the ox, you get like a free pass, right? You only get damages if you knew that it was likely to gore, like it had gored in the past. But how can you apply that principle to abandon a piece of property?
No, the ox is different. You get, it's half damages if it's innocent, but it's full damages if it's
I forgot. All right.
Dangerous. And we'll see that concept coming out either. We'll see that concept coming out as well. So I want to go into a little discursion here about Rav and Shmuel, because these are famous names in the Talmud. Don't worry, we won't cover anything that's on this page.
My favorites.
But you know, one of my goals is always to make these people come alive, that they're real people who had backgrounds and different points of view and different experiences in life. So Rav and Shmuel are first generation Amoraim from Babylonia, which means they lived around 230 CE. And this was right after Rabbi Judah the Prince closed the Mishnah. So they're the first people that started the Gemara. And they are a very famous pair in the Talmud. Rav and Shmuel always go together, like Hillel and Shammai, which everyone knows. So Rav, first of all, was a title that was given to him, just like Rabbi Judah the Prince was called Rebbe out of affection. This guy was called Rav in the same way. He was born in Babylon, but he went to Eretz Yisrael to study with Rabbi Judah the Prince. And he would stay there for a while and go back. And this was kind of common in the early days. Scholars from both Babylon and Israel went back and forth and brought traditions back and forth in that way. So they were like visiting scholars, and they did a lot of cross-pollination of ideas and viewpoints. When you study the Talmud in a scholarly way, it's sometimes interesting to trace who came up with the ideas from where. Now, Rav's real name was Abba, which is not much of a help, which we all know is father. And he was known to be very tall and strong and handsome. So he was called Abba Aricha, and Aricha means tall. So he was called Tall Abba, was his name actually. he was actually, this is good help, this is inspiration for me. He was actually relatively unknown as a scholar until he reached his 60s. And then he became the head of the yeshiva in the city of Sura, which is one of the famous yeshiva cities in Babylon. And it was basically the Harvard of yeshivot until around the year 1000 CE. Now, Rav had a colleague by the name of Shmuel, and Shmuel was head of the Jewish community in Nehardia. So if Sura was Harvard, Nehardia was Yale. And Shmuel was the guy, by the way, we owe, because he was the father of the Jewish calendar, because he was an expert in, among other things, astronomy. So the calendar we follow today, the written permanent calendar, comes from Shmuel. So Rav and Shmuel are famous because they were the originators of the give and take in Talmud, which is the hallmark of Talmud. They had differing opinions on most subjects, and these opinions were recorded and discussed and analyzed. And even though Rav was a good deal older than Shmuel, when Shmuel died, Rav wept, and he said, "The man that I feared has died." Now, one of the questions that's always interesting is, how do you know who's right in the Talmud? Because as you see, we have a lot of these discussions, and we don't get the answer. So what I pasted onto this page was some of the rules for arguing what the halakha is. So just to look at the very first one, when Rav and Shmuel have a difference, the halakha goes according to Rav if it's a ritual law, and it goes according to Shmuel if it's a monetary law. And then it gets more and more fine-tuned. And this goes all the way for all kinds of people in the Talmud. So this is why you never get the answer in the Talmud, and I never know what the answer is either, because basically you have to go look it up in the end to see who's right. So that's just a little interlude of real life from the Talmud. But now we get back to our program. So we're going to start asking these questions, which we did in the last section, about the other damagers, why do we need them, and so on. So why is pit different? So the question here is, right, we already talked about why do we need a category of ox and why do we need, I'm sorry, horn and foot and tooth. Why do we need the category of fire? And the unique thing about fire is its initial formation. That is, I'm sorry, I said fire, I meant pit. The digging of a pit is a physical action you take that can cause damage, doesn't necessarily have to cause damage. And that initial digging, the creation of a pit, is under your control and it's in your possession. So that's what makes pit a unique topic. Now, second to this is, now I have to look at my, okay. The second question we're going to ask, now I have my notes out of date. So that's that. So now we come back to the Rav Papa issue, which is the secondary and the primary. So the secondary of the pit, we have just learned, is equal to the primary of the pit. And here we have Rav Papa who says they can be different. So how do we reconcile that? And if you'll recall, this has happened pretty much in every session. No, Rav Papa wasn't talking about pit. He was talking about the next case on the list, Mave, which is the crop-destroying beast, which we will get to. So up until now, we have not yet had a case where the primary and the secondary were equal. Okay, we get another my nihu. So now we're going to start with a question of an argument between Rav and Shmuel. I told you they would not go away. You'll be very familiar with them by the next session. So we're still asking this question, the Rav Papa question, about primaries and secondaries. So Shmuel says, if Mave, the category of crop-destroying beast, is really the category of tooth, then we know that the secondary of tooth is the same as the primary of tooth. So the Rav Papa issue of looking for a difference, according to Shmuel, it's not here because they're the same. But now we have Rav, and Rav says, no, no, Mave isn't like tooth. Mave refers to human beings. Now, this is a category we have not done of damagers, and we will return to it, God willing, in the future. But just like we had the four categories from the Mishnah of ox and pit and mave and fire, there is another category of damager called human. And we haven't discussed it at all. It's going to come up. So Rav says mave is not like the tooth. It's really like the human. So if we accept that as a premise, and we know nothing about this right now, then do we have secondaries and primaries in the case of a human? And now, Lawrence, we're going to get to your answer. So how do we differentiate primary and secondary categories with humans? And the Talmud wants to make this distinction. Primary damage for a human is when they are awake, and the secondary damages for a human is when they are asleep. Meaning, you're awake and you hurt somebody, that's a primary cause of damage. You know what you're doing. But what if you're sleeping and you roll over and you, I don't want to be graphic, you damage a vessel. You get hit in the head by an anonymous person. Then your liability is obviously, well, one would think it's obviously different. So that's kind of the case. We're going to say humans are primary case is awake, secondary case is asleep. Talmud, Lawrence, comes along and says no, because a human is always in that category, muad, of the ox that gores, of the known dangerous animal, whether he's awake or whether she's asleep. Yes. So that is rejected. That would mean, going back one, that Shmuel says the primary and the secondary are the same, then Rav would have to say the primary and the secondary are the same because of the nature of humans. All right, Talmud still wants to wiggle out of this. So maybe there's another way we could differentiate humans as primaries and secondaries. And I'm going to warn you now, there is no topic that Talmud will not discuss in frank language. So they're saying no. What if the secondary, the human, is damaged caused by his mucus, or you think I gave you said phlegm or spit? So how might that cause damage?
This is relevant today.
Yeah, you know, very.
You're actually right. And the person says, so they say, what's different here? What is the case? What are the specifics? Well, if the damage was done while the person was in motion, then it comes on his own power, meaning he's the primary source of damage. But if, let's say, I spit on the street and then I went away and then you came along and you stepped in it and you slipped, now we're back to the case of pit, like leaving the objects in the public domain that you trip on. So if the person was moving, then this is just damages done by a person. And if it was the spit or the mucus that caused damage, then this is the category of the pit. A person abandoned something in the public domain. So what's the conclusion? The conclusion is whatever one you come up with, it turns out the secondary of mave is equivalent to mave. And once again, Rav Papa is confounded. So once again, we've got to move the goalpost and say, well, he wasn't talking about any of the other 10 things we've talked about already. He's really talking about fire, which is our last category of damagers. This is known as kicking the can down the road.
Until you run out of road.
Now we come back again to the same exact question. Before, the Talmud wants to get secondaries and primaries. Are they the same? Are they different? So what is the secondary for fire? If you say it is a stone, a knife, or a load, and you place those on top of your roof, and the wind came by and blew it down, and then someone tripped on it, then in what circumstances? So you're liable for that damage. However, if it did damage in the act of falling, so I guess this would be graphic, you know, the New York City case where you're walking down the street and the air conditioner falls on your head, or the loose mortar falls on your head. That's what fire is.
Question.
Yeah.
Relate that to snow on the roof of someone's car that they don't clear off.
That, I don't know. So let's think out loud. Is that a primary responsibility or a secondary responsibility?
Primary, because it's illegal to leave it on top of your roof, the roof of your car.
You could foresee that would create a problem.
And they're in motion.
And it's in motion.
Yeah.
So therefore it's primary.
So I think you're right. We'll see in one more thing. I want to make one point here, which is interesting. In the second sentence, notice the Talmud says explicitly, fell down by a normal wind, meaning a normal occurrence, which means you are responsible because you could have anticipated that a normal wind would come and blow your thing over. However, if it is an abnormal wind, you know, an unprepared storm or a once-in-a-lifetime flood, then you don't have the same liability. And we can derive all of that from the word normal, which is in the text.
Wouldn't that change in today's times when they can tell you in advance a storm is coming, a flood is coming, so that you do know it's not, it may be unusual or more severe than normal,
but you had every warning that it was going to happen.
So I think you could be on a baked in on a court today and make that case that a normal wind in Talmudic times, we need to update the definition of a normal wind. Not that the wind has changed, but you're correct, Lynn. I think it would be an entirely reasonable argument to say, nowadays we know that bad wind is coming, so we need to take extra precautions.
Yeah, but for instance, in the case of a hurricane, we know that a hurricane's coming and I tie down the loose furniture on my patio, but the hurricane all of a sudden becomes unforeseen strong that we didn't anticipate, the rope breaks, and my furniture goes flying all over the neighborhood.
So I think you could make a case again that that is an abnormal right. wind in an abnormal hurricane.
Right, and you took reasonable precautions in order to prevent any damage from occurring.
I will, at least after the fact.
But what I like here a lot is you guys are thinking Talmudically. This is the goal. Words are important and ideas are important, and this is kind of the Jewish quest, is to take a look at these texts and make them work today. And I think that that's what we're doing. So back to the question of the snow on the car, maybe this will help. So again, our favorite question, what's unique about fire that we needed a category for it? And the answer is fire is aided by an external force and is in your possession and is under your control. So Steve, to go back to the case of the snow on the roof, yes, it gets blown by the wind. Is it in your possession and it is and is it under your control? And I leave the answer to the reader. I would tend to say yes, that's clearly within your control.
Yeah, the snow is under your control, not the wind.
No, but the anticipation of the wind is, again, something that you should be doing and controlling for it.
So the question I would ask on this, by the way, I always think about this. What if you're driving a truck or an SUV and you're short and you can't reach the top of the roof to get the snow off?
Well, that's why New Jersey established a law that says you better find a way to get up there.
Okay.
Because you're liable.
Ladders, they have extensions.
Sure.
Which may not be the easiest thing to do if there's a 3-foot snowdrift around your car.
You shouldn't be driving.
Stay home.
You got to clean that away first, and then you clean your room.
Do it by, work from home. Do it by Zoom.
As a wise sage once said, your mileage may vary.
Okay. So that's fire. So now we come to the next question. Back to the Rav Papa thing. So we have now established the secondary of fire is equal to the primary of fire. So what case can we possibly have now that we've gone through all the damagers where the primary is not the secondary? And now we come up with, he's referring to the secondary of foot. So we're kind of reaching here. This statement is problematic, but it looks like we have an answer. Foot, exclamation marks are mine. Did we not already establish that the secondary of foot is equal to the foot? And now we throw in, this is the Talmudic equivalent of pulling the rabbit out of the hat, just like before. We have a tradition, as you see in the bottom, a halakha learned by tradition, meaning this just came in. And the answer here is in secondary case of foot, one of the cases we talked about is where the animal kicks up a stone and the stone causes damage. And in that case, you are only responsible for half damages, not for full damages. And now we have fulfilled Rav Papa's criteria of the secondary being different from the primary. I know you're all stunned by this.
How often did an ox walking kick up pebbles? I mean, it's not like they're flinging their hooves around.
Obviously, you didn't grow up on a farm. course, neither did I. So no, I don't know. But the Talmud does not say it's plausible rumor. It's giving you a case. And you could make an argument today that a car could spin out on a rutted road and kick up a lot of pebbles,
absolutely,
stones. That
could,
kind
could
of
do thing. That on the parkway, but
yes. So, and why do we call this a secondary of the foot? To pay from the best of property. So the Gemara is asking here, is it, it's a unique halakhic category that the payment is different. Why is that categorized as a subcat, as a secondary? And the Gemara explains, it's due to the fact that it shares a common aspect with walking. That was actually the secondary, is walking of foot. One whose animal propels pebbles while it walks and thereby causes damage is liable to pay half the damages from his best property. And we haven't talked about the best property thing yet, so that's going to be in the future. And he does not pay only from the body of the animal, as the halakha concerning half the cost of the damage paid by the owner of an animal that gored a person or an animal. So that's the distinction they're trying to throw in. Now we're going back to Rava, who doesn't like this. But did not Rava raise a dilemma? And you'll see raise a dilemma a lot. Rava did raise a dilemma. Half damages from the pebble of pebbles from the body is paid or from the best of the property. So the problem is that this was a question that Rava is going to ask down the road, which we haven't seen yet, later in the tractate. By the way, this is again why you know it's called the Sea of Talmud, because the fact that the case occurs later doesn't affect the fact that they can bring the question up now. Is, do you pay from the value of the animal, in which case that would raise a cap on the amount of damages, or from your own property or for your own bank account, if you will? So to Rava, this was a dilemma, but to Rav Papa, it was obvious. It is obvious to Rav Papa that one pays from his own property. And in that sense, then he can say the pebbles that cause damage are a subcategory of walking. So to Rava, who raises the question, how is it called the secondary of the foot? So Rava needs to find another aspect in which the damage of pebbles is similar to the damage of foot, because to him, it might be that the damage done by the pebbles is not similar to the damage done by the foot. So he's going to make a different distinction, which we've now seen a lot of. And what he's saying is that both are exempt when they are done in the public domain. And that's what that last word in Hebrew is, Bereshut Harabim, with the chipchuk. That's an acronym. It's a Rashi Tevot. So this ends our discussion of all the secondaries of the principal damaging agents. This sugya, yes.
You know, because we brought automobiles in, do they cover at all? I'm driving along perfectly safely, perfectly, everything's okay. Somebody rear-ends me so with such velocity that I ram into the car in front of me. We now have a three-car accident. I'm the middle car. I caused the damage to the car in front of me. You know, my ox gored the ox in front of me, but not for my own volition, from the tom ox that, you know, gored me in the first place. Is that covered any place?
The honest answer is I don't know.
It's covered in law today.
I know it's covered in law, but I'm asking about Talmud.
I don't know. My initial thought is you would have to break that down into the two different segments. The first segment would be the person injuring you, and the second segment would be you injuring the third party. and you'd have to apply the initial principles in each case, right? We talked here a lot about, for example, whether the damage is secondary or primary. Is it caused by you or is it caused indirectly by you? And I would imagine in part two of your scenario, the damage is caused indirectly by you and you wouldn't necessarily have at least full responsibility. You might have some responsibility, right? I'm thinking out loud, like maybe you were too close to the car in front of you, even though you didn't cause the accident, but nevertheless damage was caused and someone's responsible.
But suppose this is a situation that happened to me and we were all parked, we were all stopped at a stoplight. And then one guy, two of us were. And then the third guy comes up and he doesn't see the stoplight and rams into the middle car, which then was stopped, wasn't even moving at the time, but because of the force of the impact, hits the car in front of him. So now you have everyone damaged. But the middle car wasn't driving at that time. It was just sitting, waiting for a light to change.
With or without the brakes on?
Well, presumably with brakes makes, on, if you're stopped.
Probably, but you have to be braking if you're stopped.
But that doesn't mean anything. Your car is still going to move if you're hit.
Yeah, the tires may not rotate, but you're going to get pushed forward.
You'd be pushed into the other car.
Right.
Right. So
but if you're far enough away from the other car and you have your foot firmly on the brake when you're hitting the rear, you're going to have less responsibility. Among other things, you're giving the car behind you a warning that you're stopped. If your foot's not on the brake, then you haven't given him a warning that you're stopped and you may move forward easy.
But there's a stoplight that he should be seeing because it's up high.
I don't know how you could be. I don't know how you could be stopped without having the brakes on. You would have to be on very level ground or the shift car.
Just on level ground.
You still have your foot on the brake.
But in most cases,
not necessarily. You're wrong.
I have my foot on the brake.
I often have my foot off the brake, and if I see somebody coming, I put my brakes on.
Well, but in either case, the distance between you and the car that stopped in front of you is something under your control.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that may factor, I'm not a lawyer, that may factor in.
No, but I'm asking if Talma does this, you know, in other words, the only reason my ox ran forward and gored your ox was because another ox attacked him and he was trying to get away from him. He really wasn't trying to gore your